Our last case this morning is 2020-0091. State of Ohio, ex rel David Yost, Ohio Attorney General versus Rover Pipeline LLC et al. For the appellant, Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents two questions. Today, I plan to focus on the first, which involves the consequences of a state's failure to timely act on a 401 certification request. And frankly, on this issue, there's more agreement between the parties now than there is disagreement. Rover does not defend the Fifth District's holding below that the consequence of a waiver is that a state may never enforce any water quality law against a federal permit holder, even in response to pollution beyond the scope of the federal permit. So the dispute at this point boils down to what rule ought to replace the one the Fifth District announced. So let me start there with our rule, which has two parts. The first defines the waiver. The second defines the consequences. The waiver itself is a waiver of the right to participate in the process, in the federal permitting process. And that follows from the text of 401, which the only time it speaks about waiver is when it says that what's waived is are the certification requirements with respect to the federal application. The certification requirements are simply the obligation to consult with the state during the permitting process. So that's the waiver itself. What are the consequences of that waiver? Well, the rule that we propose in our briefing is the same rule that Rover itself suggested in footnote 7 of its Fifth District brief. A state that waives the right to participate cannot enforce state law in response to discharges that were anticipated by the federal permit, but it can continue to enforce state law in response to discharges, I'll just quote from their brief, that go beyond the scope of those anticipated by the federal permit.
Is that the argument you made below?
It is not the argument we made below. When we came up here, we narrowed the argument. Previously argued that there was no restriction whatsoever on what the state could enforce its power with respect to. And candidly, we've concluded that's not the best argument. And so came up here with a narrower version of the argument we brought below, which is that we can punish them for at least some of the violations alleged, including in particular, the discharge of drilling fluid that was laced with diesel fuel. That's actually a good opportunity to connect the rule.
Isn't the scope of the permits to cover discharges? I mean, isn't that what you waived?
No. So if you look at the text of 401, the only thing you waive is the right to participate in the process. But as far as the consequences go, what we've waived is the ability to punish violations that occur with respect to the project as it's described in the federal permitting process. We obviously can't anticipate projects that are implemented or carried out in some completely unforeseeable way. So to take an extreme example, Rover here throughout the permitting process said that it would use water and non-toxic bentonite clay in its drilling fluid. That was what it said it was used, and that's what we were presented with in the process. Let's suppose that let's put diesel fuel to the side. Let's suppose that they said, you know what, it's cheaper for some reason, instead of using diesel fuel, we'll use massive amounts of radioactive waste, no water or clay at all. Even they would concede, I would hope, that that's beyond the scope of the federal permit because it's completely unanticipated by the federal permit. So what we need to ask in this case is whether the discharge that occurred here, allegedly, and remember, we're still at the motion to dismiss stage, so we have to assume the truth of the well-pleaded allegations. The discharge here involved a discharge of drilling fluid that contained water, the non-toxic bentonite clay. They said they would use that laced with diesel fuel. There's nothing in the federal permitting process that described the project as containing that. And so the state did not give up its authority to enforce state law in connection with that discharge. To maybe put a finer point on it, I can talk a little bit.
Counsel, what would the federal government do with a breach like that?
With a breach like the one that actually occurred?
Yeah.
Well, to our knowledge, there's been no fine at all. They did oversee the cleanup, but of course, a key part of our—
They halted the, production, if you will, and the operation and forced them to do cleanup, correct?
Correct.
Issue of a fine off the table?
I don't know that it's off the table, though it wouldn't be up to us. And that's the key point here. It's not that the federal government couldn't do anything. It's that the states in our form of government are not obligated to depend on the federal government to defend their citizens and their rights for them. But let me to maybe draw a little bit of a distinction between anticipated discharges and unanticipated discharges. Let me talk about some of the things that we, or one thing at least, that we did waive. that we can no longer enforce our state law with response to. The permitting process, no doubt, disclosed a risk that there would be a risk of inadvertent returns, which means the drilling fluid comes to the surface. And so with respect to the inadvertent returns that involved nothing but the water and the non-toxic bentonite clay that they said they would use, we at this stage now concede that the state cannot enforce its laws with respect to that. But if Rover had laced, again, its drilling fluid with radioactive waste, or human waste for that matter, or diesel fuel, that's beyond the scope of what they ever suggested could occur in the course of the project. So it's not the project, it's not the activity with respect to which we made any waiver at all. Now, in addition to that discharge, which is sort of the main discharge at issue here, we also have in count 6 of the complaint, an allegation that Rover violated the terms of a hydrostatic permit it obtained outside of the permitting process. Let me explain why that count is also valid, at least at the motion to dismiss stage. Again, the waiver is a waiver of the right to participate in the process. It's not a waiver of a right to do anything ever in connection with the federal permit holder, and it's certainly not a waiver of the federal permit holder's right to engage in outside agreements. So let's say that instead of a hydrostatic permit from the state, Rover had entered into a contract with a private landowner in Ohio, in which it agreed to all the terms of the hydrostatic permit and said, we'll follow those terms in exchange for some sum of money. If that had occurred, it's beyond dispute, I think, that that would be a valid contract. And just as the federally regulated party can agree to terms that go over and above what federal law requires with the private party, it can agree outside the process to new terms with the state. Doesn't mean the state can unilaterally impose those terms. That would be a different case. But if they independently agree with to abide by these terms outside of the process, the waiver of the right to participate in the process simply has nothing to do with it. And what I want to stress, going back to the rule we're suggesting here, as I noted, as we've honed our position as we came up, it is a rule that was at least suggested by Rover, again, in footnote 7 of its Fifth District brief. You can also look at footnote 13 of its motion to dismiss, where it said, we want to be clear, the state doesn't give up its ability to enforce state law in response to discharges that were, quote, not contemplated. Well, it was never contemplated that they would add diesel fuel to their drilling fluid and inject it right below the highest quality wetlands or some of the highest quality wetlands in Ohio. That's what's alleged to occur.
I guess what I'm having trouble with is that it seems to, as I look at the statute, what the certification is about is a project. And it seems the state waived its ability to attach conditions to this project, including that they comply with state law. So I guess the problem I have with your argument is I don't understand how the court would ever go through and figure out what was anticipated and what wasn't anticipated. It seems like a completely nebulous kind of inquiry.
Well, let me answer in reverse order. In terms of what the court would look at, it would look at the filings made in the federal application. And it might have to hear from experts, but oftentimes it can look at that and see what discharges were disclosed.
Isn't the point of having conditions is to preclude, you know, is to prevent harm from stopping that goes beyond what's anticipated. That's why you attach conditions that you do certain things, because you don't always know what might happen.
No, to the contrary, the state's role in the certification process. So even if it issues a certification, its role in that certification process is to impose conditions or not on the project as described. You asked sort of what is the project? That's really what this comes down to. The project doesn't mean anything that carries out the end that they seek. For example, building a pipeline. Even they concede, I think, that if you were to use pure radioactive waste as drilling fluid, that would not be the project at issue here because it wasn't the project as described. And I can give you some statutory hooks for this understanding of the state's role. The first is to remember the default rule. Under both Ohio law and the Clean Water Act, all discharges are prohibited until they're affirmatively permitted. So if in the permitting process, they don't come forward and say that there's a risk of a certain thing happening, the permit doesn't allow that and it remains illegal. But I can also point you to 401A3 of the Clean Water Act. What that statute says is if the state issues a certification, the certification is valid not only for the federal license in connection with which it was sought, but also for future federal licenses. But there's an exception. if the construction or operation of the facility changes, in other words, if the project with respect to which the certification was issued is not the same project that's actually being implemented because something about it changed, the certification is no longer valid and the pipeline or the federal permittee has to get a new permit. So that shows again that the focus of the state's role is on the permit, is on the project rather, as it's described, not every logically conceivable iteration of the project. And if there's any doubt about that, I think you have to read the consequences in light of the bond principle. Again, 401 does not say anything about the consequences. When we talk about the consequences, we're talking about what we can infer from the statutory structure. If Congress had intended to tell the state that you lose, as the Fifth District said, literally all of your authority to go after the federal permit holder for any pollution that occurs in connection with the permitted project, it needed to say that expressly. That's a massive loss of sovereign power, but there's nothing expressed in the statute that says that. And our federalist system requires that we read the statutes to preserve state authority. And indeed, the Clean Water Act,
Don't the appellees sort of tacitly recognize that it's based on the project when they modified their plan and received a new certification because of alterations to their original plan?
I think at the time, yes, they recognized that that was a different project. And again, maybe they can come up here and explain why, if they had used radioactive waste, that would still be covered by the permit. I don't think they can. I read their brief to give away that much, but if they give away that much, what we're left with is the rule they suggested in footnote 7 of their Fifth District brief. The state retains its power to enforce state law against unanticipated discharges. If I can make one thing clear about,
Council, that does not have to be spelled out in a certification process, that the state retains its sovereign rights, for any purpose at this point. Maybe not, you know, what you're describing is the limited contents of the certification process and the state missed out on participating in that. But as you're saying, there can't be a blanket denial of the state's sovereign rights just because there's this, you know, certification process that is gone through.
I completely agree with that. That's exactly the argument we're making, is that if Congress wanted that to be the consequence, it needed to say so expressly, and it simply doesn't. I see my time's running short.
Well, then my point is every certification project or the certification process does not have to explicitly say, oh, by the way, Ohio gets to retain its sovereignty with regards to its statutes.
Correct. We're not required by the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, to do that. And in fact, the Clean Water Act, if you look at 33 USC 1370, expressly says it does not interfere with the state's right to regulate water quality as long as they do it in a way that's consistent with federal law. Before I sit down, I'll just quickly make the point. With respect to anticipated versus unanticipated, keep in mind we're still at the motion to dismiss stage. So there will be a chance for them to say that, in fact, this was disclosed somewhere. They haven't showed where that is here, where that occurred, but maybe they can do it on remand. That would be a question for later. I know there's also a second question. We think our briefs adequately address those arguments. I'm happy to take questions, but otherwise I'd ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You've saved about a minute and a half. For Rover Pipeline, we first have Mr. DeBold. Council, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Sorry. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Mr. Knauth, counsel for Laney, will be using two of our 15 minutes. The issue in this case is not whether water pollution will be regulated, but who will regulate it, and in a very narrow context. First, you're only dealing with federally licensed activities that could result in discharges to a state's waters. And even there, we are only dealing with the situation where a state chooses to take no action within 1 year of a water quality certification request, which two courts of appeals have held means that the regulation of the project as a whole returns to FERC for its plenary authority, which it has in the first place under the Natural Gas Act. Congress put complete authority over natural gas pipeline construction in a federal agency, and it gave states ample time to participate in establishing the rules of the road that would be relevant to water quality before construction begins. Every lawyer knows that time limits on which to act in a filing or otherwise are very important, and that failure to comply with them can have serious consequences. But those consequences are not serious in this case, because if a state does not act within 1 year, authority remains in FERC's hands to set and enforce environmental conditions, which is exactly what happened in this case. The state, recognizing that it was FERC's decision how to handle these discharges, turned to FERC when the discharges occurred and asked FERC to issue a stop work order, which FERC did. It also asked FERC to require remediation, which FERC again did, and Rover has spent tens of millions of dollars remediating the discharges at issue in this case. FERC also changed the conditions and terms of its license by adding further requirements, such as hiring an independent third party to review the methods that were being used, a doubling of environmental inspectors, the change in the drilling to go deeper beneath the ground, and multiple equipment modifications that were designed to and did detect and prevent larger inadvertent returns. Only after FERC was satisfied and the state indicated its satisfaction with these various measures did FERC allow the work to resume on these types of activities. And that is exactly the way the process works when you have a federal license and the state has an option, not an obligation, but an option to participate in the process. The state's proposed rule, which it newly argues in this court, and frankly, it's hard to fault the Fifth District for not commenting on this version of the rule, because in the Fifth District, the state took the position that only discharges of fill material, which fall within the jurisdiction of the Army Corps of Engineers, are affected by a waiver under 401, which is why the Fifth District did not address the argument that the state is raising here. But be that as it may, the state's proposed ruling here, or proposed rule here, would basically require, would allow a state to come in after the fact at a time when only FERC may set conditions on a license and add conditions to that project after the project has already gotten underway. The way the state is supposed to participate in the certification process is not simply to say, we want you to follow all of our laws. What the state does in the certification process, it makes a cost-benefit analysis. What effects on water quality is the state willing to accept? In this case, the state, when it issued its untimely certification, said that the lowering of water quality in 11 watersheds was acceptable because of the nature of the project and what it wanted the project to accomplish.
But you're saying that because the state didn't certify within a year, you're saying that's what basically was the state's belief?
That when the state didn't act on the certification within a year, it had a choice of either denying it, which would have halted the project, or it could have granted it, including with conditions. And if the state had participated in the process and set conditions, then we would not have the waiver issue that's before the court today.
I understand, but what this difference between the activity and the project, the project is as defined in whatever FERC certifies in the end, whether the state's participated in that process or not. But if it steps outside of that project, you're saying the state still can't step in and enforce its laws?
There's a distinction between the activity that's licensed by FERC and that FERC has authority over, and that activity is the construction of a natural gas pipeline. There's a distinction between activity and the word discharges. And what the state does in its reply brief is it conflates the two, when clearly the statute is designed to make sure that when a license to conduct activity, and I'm quoting from 401A, when a license to conduct an activity such as construction of facilities is applied for, then the applicant has to go to the state and seek a certification that the activity, to the extent it may result in discharges, would be in compliance with state's environmental laws.
I understand, but activity and project, you're interchanging those words, am I right?
And for good reason, because the activity that's referenced in 401A is the construction of the facility that is subject to the federal license. The Supreme Court addressed this issue directly in subsection 401D, where a state wanted to add conditions that were not directly tied to the discharges that the applicant raised when it submitted its application. And the Supreme Court said the scope of the conditions that are covered under 401D, which have to go into the certification if the state finds them to be necessary to protect water quality, the scope of those conditions is broader than the discharge that may have been disclosed by the applicant. The Supreme Court said that section, this is at pages 711 to 712 of the Public Utility District number one case that we cite in our brief. Section 401A identifies the category of activities subject to certification. And 401D is most reasonably read as authorizing additional conditions and limitations on the activity as a whole once the threshold condition, the existence of a discharge, is satisfied. So just as a state that participates in the process and decides that it wants to act within 1 year shall include in the certification all conditions necessary to comply with the Clean Water Act and with other applicable state requirements, the state that doesn't participate in the process has given up the opportunity to set those conditions.
But I understand one more thing. So, but the application that goes to FERC and that FERC approves, it's pretty lengthy and it's descriptive, and it's going to be specific. So if an applicant, even after they're certified, sort of changes course and does it differently, have they stepped outside of that activity or that project? Because it was certified to be done in a certain way.
So it turns on what the scope of the federal agency's jurisdiction is. And here there is no question that FERC has authority to bring action when there is a discharge that occurs that is outside the scope of what FERC anticipated. And in fact, in this case, FERC has an investigation that's been pending since 2017, specifically based on the discharge of the inadvertent returns that contain diesel fuel. And that is referenced in the September 18th, 2017 letter that is cited in our brief, where FERC gave permission for the project to go forward. It reminded Rover that there was still a pending investigation of the discharges that resulted in the diesel fuel being detected. So clearly it's within FERC's jurisdiction. FERC has the authority to enforce violations of its permits, of its license, of its conditions. What the state is seeking to do here is come forward and say, we think you violated the conditions of the FERC license. Therefore, we are going to start enforcing our laws in response to that. And it creates a lot of real administrability problems because, for example, the FERC license has conditions that require certain things to be reported within a certain period of time. FERC takes the position that if there's an inadvertent return, it has to be reported promptly. There has to be a coordination effort for how to respond to it. There has to be remediation and so forth. Under the state's view, if the applicant, if Rover in this case, missed the timing to report the inadvertent return by an hour or 2 hours, that would mean we're in violation of the permit by FERC. We have no longer done a discharge or done activity that is within the scope of the license. And the state can come in and enforce a law that applies to any discharge without a permit. That's the way the state laws are written. So that means that the state would then be enforcing this law that is not tailored to the circumstances here.
That's your kind of extreme hypothetical. What about Mr. Flowers' hypothetical about started using radioactive waste for the project?
It would turn on whether the discharge at issue there was within the scope of the carrying out the construction activity, building the pipeline. And it would also turn on whether FERC would have jurisdiction over that particular activity, because FERC is the one that issues the license.
Okay, well, now, say it was used in building the pipeline.
FERC would then take action against that discharge, because FERC is the agency that has jurisdiction when a state returns its delegated authority back to FERC by not acting within 1 year on a water quality certification request. That's how the line gets drawn, and it's a way to make sure that one way or the other, the discharge is subject to regulation, subject to remediation, which occurred in this case with the kinds of discharges the state was arguing here.
Counsel, under this scenario, we have a radioactive discharge. I thought I heard you say that if there was a radioactive discharge, that would be exclusively under FERC because of the nature of the activity that precipitated that discharge. Is that right?
If it meets the definition of being something that occurred while carrying out the construction activity that was licensed by the federal agency.
Okay. So, if Rover was not licensed to use that radioactive agent, that's FERC, right?
FERC would, if it used a material that was not disclosed to FERC, which is the basis for the investigation involving the diesel fuel.
Right.
FERC is asserting that you said you were going to use bentonite and water. You never told us about diesel. Now we're investigating that because it's beyond the scope of what we authorized.
Okay.
That's why it falls into FERC's hands.
All right. If Ohio had not missed the deadline for certification and the scenario came up where there was radioactive discharge that was not disclosed as part of the initial application for certification, who would FERC still take be responsible for what for the what they do with that discharge, the remediation, and whatever consequences are meted out to Rover?
FERC still acts in the first instance. Then there would
Does the state have any rights under that scenario?
There are two arguments that were made in the trial court, but not considered by the court of, by the Fifth District. One of them is a different preemption argument, and the other one is that improper collateral attack argument. And those arguments would be available to appellees on remand if the court were to reverse. Very briefly, the collateral attack argument essentially is that when a state asks FERC to take action in response to pollution, and FERC refuses to take the action that the state requires, the proper remedy for the state is then to appeal to a federal court of appeals. There's a specific provision in the Natural Gas Act that applies here. It's not a Clean Water Act argument, it's a Natural Gas Act argument. So there is that separate argument that we would have to litigate as far as what happens in a case where the state does comply with the one-year time limit and does set conditions on its certification rather than just giving a blanket certification.
Okay, thank you. We're down to the 2 minutes that you've reserved for Mr. Knopf.
I will reserve those for him. Thank you.
Before Mr. Bowe leaves, can I ask one question?
Sure.
I'm struggling to understand. I understand your argument about the diesel fuel, but I'm struggling to understand the permit argument. It seems, as I understand it, FERC says you have to get the state permit. They go to the state, they get the permit, they agree to be bound by the state's conditions of that permit. It's the condition of getting it. That's post any waiver, I guess. Why couldn't the state enforce that?
There is a timing issue here that I think that the state elides, and that is that the requirement by FERC for Rover to get the hydrostatic test water permit, that condition was put in the environmental impact statement, which was issued in July of 2016, which was about 4 months before the Ohio deadline for acting on the water quality certification ran out. So FERC included that, and with the understanding, it also included that we had to get a 401 certification because, again, we had four months waiting for Ohio to act or not. So it was an anticipation of the state participating in the process, which the state had already been participating, and there was no reason to believe it wouldn't. When the state then waived by not acting on the certification, the requirement, to the extent it applied, is a requirement that FERC enforces. Pursuant to the license, because it was.
But the state didn't waive its right to enforce its permit, did it? I mean, there was no, that would seem a separate. I mean, once they'd applied for a permit, it would seem like that would require some kind of separate waiver from the state.
Well, the permit requirement only existed because FERC required it as a condition of its license. And so it remains to FERC whether or not to enforce or take action with respect to any activity that is perceived to be beyond the scope of the hydrostatic test water requirements.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, we ask that the court affirm.
Okay, Mr. Knopf, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tom Knoth, and I represent Laney Directional Drilling, I'm also speaking on behalf of three other contractors that are appellees: Atlas Trenchless, B&T Directional Drilling, and Mears Group. We are arguing separately to explain that these four contractors prevail even on the state's new limited waiver argument. And interestingly enough, the state made a concession in its argument that because of this limited waiver, that it cannot enforce state laws against just discharges of bentonite clay and water. And as it turns out, all the claims against these four contractors in the Third Amendment complaint alleges precisely that, that they had inadvertent returns or discharges of the very same drilling fluid of non-toxic bentonite clay and water. There was no allegation that these contractors discharged anything like diesel fuel, and there's no claim against them that they violated the terms of a permit. So given the state's concession and given the fact that we believe the state has waived its delegated authority under Section 401 by not acting within 1 year after it received the certification request, we believe, given all this, that the court should affirm the judgment below dismissing all the claims against Laney, Atlas, B&T, and Mears because the state can no longer regulate those discharges. That's all I have. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I have four quick points that I'll try to get through in my limited time. First, my friend on the other side referenced the fact that this is a federally licensed project. To the extent he's invoking the Natural Gas Act, it's irrelevant here. 15 USC 717B subsection D says that the Natural Gas Act does not preempt. It shall have no effect on any of the state's rights under the Clean Water Act. One of the rights under the Clean Water Act are not only the delegated rights that they talk about, but also the inherent rights, because 33 USC 1370 preserves the state's inherent authority to regulate water. Second, Rover said that the test here is unadministrable. That's a strange suggestion because the test I suggested was literally quoting from the brief they filed in the Fifth District, footnote 7 of that brief, footnote 13 of their motion to dismiss. With respect to the role in the process, Rover suggests that the state's role is just to determine what effect, you know, what do a cost benefit analysis and determine whether the potential costs are worth the potential benefits. Well, that just shows why our test is right. We can't do the cost benefit analysis if they don't disclose all of the potential costs. And at least at the motion to dismiss stage, the release of diesel is potentially so far beyond what was discussed in the permitting process that there's no waiver as a matter of law. Finally, they suggest at length, both in their brief and here, that we don't really need to worry about this because FERC can regulate it. Well, as an initial matter, FERC might not regulate it in some future case. But the most important point is that Ohio is a sovereign state. We're not a conquered people who have to look to the federal government to defend our interests. Unless Congress expressly takes away our power to do so, it has not done so. And there's nothing in the Clean Water Act that takes away that power. To the contrary, 33 USC 1370 preserves it.
Do you have any response to Mr. Knoth's argument?
I do. He's correct that we're no longer seeking relief on the discharge of water and non-toxic bentonite clay, but they shouldn't be dismissed at this stage because the complaint makes clear that we have alleged that the parties are jointly and severally liable. Now, on remand, they could argue that they're not jointly and severally liable, but they haven't made that argument here.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.